Accession number 16755, Reel 5.
Colonel Strangeways, Reel 5.
Well, I arrived at the what was then Monty's headquarters, and I went across to the divisional commander, and I told him that it was a requirement that his tank should be painted green, and so far as possible, there would not be any indication that they were of the 8th Army. He said, well, now, where do I get paint from? And the men will not like taking off their 8th Army things. So I explained it was necessary for the operation. And he didn't worry about the paint. There was plenty of paint. He said, what about brushes? I said, there are plenty of brushes. And it'll all be waiting for you to collect, or people to collect, and such as an airstrip. And he was so staggered that all this come up by air, which it had, and he couldn't really refuse to do so, and he knew he couldn't, because he got a real slap up the backside. But the 8th Army was so conceited about its appearance that it hadn't struck them that if they arrived up in the 1st Army's area, all with their things, that it would show exactly what was happening. And I suppose we all get like this. We think of nothing but our own little area. But they did, and they played ball very well, and the operation was a tremendous success. But of a little thing like that, getting the paint brushes and the paint sent up by air, stopped that nonsense. But it meant that the people back in base had the confidence to react immediately for a telephone call, and it was away.
And did you use your own name, or did you have a code name? Or
no, in those days I used my own name. I was forbidden to use my own name when I was in Italy. I was given the name of Crawford, I think it was, something like that. Unfortunately, in the newspapers, there was an account of my getting an award, and why. And some stupid fellow, instead of just saying by name, he'd gone to town on the press, and oh, Lord. So I got a signal out saying, four strange ways, I think it was Crawford. But it was totally hilarious, because I'd arrive in a place and say, particularly in the American area, my name is Colonel Crawford. And that's right, it's Damwell, isn't it? I know who you are. You're David Strangeways. I said, yes, I know, but don't say so. But it was ridiculous. In the end, I let it sort of fizzle off.
Sounds rather like the script of an Ealing comedy.
Yes. But those things happen.
I asked you about the Germans and their behaviour. Did you find any difference between them and the Italians?
Between the Germans and the Italians?
Were the Italians easier to deceive or not so easy to deceive? Did they?
I think the sounds rude. I think the Italians deceived themselves more than anything else. We were totally unfrightened of the Italians, but we were pretty wary with the Germans. But in Italy, we see one was going for the Germans, not the Italians. But by the time we got into Italy, Italians were nothing. But the Germans remained. But there were two kinds of Germans. You see, there were the German army proper, which was a decent organization, and there were the German army political, which were a menace. But more to the Germans than to us. But they do things by drill. So once, for instance, we aimed a lot at Hitler, obviously, and the German high command. And what you tried to see was the story which you'd written was delivered to them in little tiny little bits, totally disconnected one another, apparently. And the head chap would receive these little bits of information, maybe an article in the paper in Portugal or something, maybe this, maybe that, maybe the other. And when he put them together brilliantly, it would produce your story. But they were disconnected. An agent this said so-and-so, somebody over there said so-and-so, and it all mixes up together. For instance, on D-Day, Monty was theoretically in Gibraltar. And that was given to them in many ways. There was a fellow who wrote a book about it, how he represented Monty and did deceive.
Yeah,
that's right. Well,
Montgomery Clift, wasn't it?
Well,
I think that was his name.
I forget his name now. But we used him. He was under me for a bit. To do what we had to do, but that wasn't the thing that did it. It was some stuff dropped in Spain, something else somewhere else, something else somewhere there, and they all got together these little bits and pieces to make the scene. And the sort of, if you like, the icing on the cake was this chap going into Malt. He did it very well into Gibraltar. He did it very well. But he did. We, in fact, could have got on just well without him, but it just was a bit extra.
And if you're trying to feed somebody the pieces of a jigsaw, then presumably every little piece has some part to play in building up the
correct
impression.
Yes. But you've got to see it's your appreciation of what resources you have which can be of any assistance. And if somebody's got it, particular double agent who does this, that, and the other, that is an asset. Again, it's an asset if there are no double agents, or there's nothing at all. And of course, the Germans had nothing whatever in England for D-Day. I mean, they just didn't exist. They'd all been turned around or bumped off.
It is said that to a historian, anything which can be used to approach truthful impression of the past is evidence. Presumably the same approach can be taken towards building a false impression. In other words, anything at all which can be used to create a false impression of the right sort would be employed.
Oh, yes. I've used Monty falling out with people a great deal. He didn't know, but I knew, and it was part of my story. For instance, when we actually attacked in the north, in the First Army area, I used it that Monty had told Alex to let the First Army stay where they were, because he will come up from the south. Well, it was just the kind of thing Monty would have said. And as he thought. So you used that. It was truthful in one way, fitted in with Monty's character. He was a bit cocky, you know, and he was damn good, but he was a bit cocky. So you played on that.
Again, it's often said that when you're engaging in deception, you can never actually put a new idea into an enemy's mind. What you can do is take a false impression he's already got and encourage it and
yeah, you can actually create and compete. Oh, yes, you can. But you do it in such a way that he doesn't know it's being done. I mean, you can't just bump into these things. You've got to work it all out. I always said I used to call it the story, because it is a story, but some stories are very convincing.
Story has to be true to life, yes. Otherwise it wouldn't be of any interest.
So it...
Was the head man you were aiming at on the German side, Admiral Canaris, was he the main target of your operations?
No, I didn't specify in my mind any particular person, but when you've been examining what the enemy is doing and getting all the ultra messages about what he is doing and his comments back and forth, you get to feel what he's feeling, and you react to that. And you just have in your head the idea of somebody who can be X, Y, or Z, it doesn't matter, sitting down, and he's being fed with stuff from all the resources, wireless traffic, all sorts of things, political things, so on and so forth. And you're blind, you see, until the operation's over, to know how successful it could be. And for D-Day, we'd no idea we'd been so successful until about D+4 or 5. We began to get pretty jittery then. But when we found the stuff was going over and still going over and still going over, it was incredible. Then we had to react against ourselves, as it were, to not make certain we didn't let anything out that shouldn't be out. But
do you think that the Germans ever rumbled any of your major deception operations?
No. I don't think they had any idea.
As David Hunt says, that in the Mediterranean, the main aim was to persuade the Germans that our principal area of interest would be the eastern Mediterranean, the area around Greece, rather than Italy and further west. Was that the case? Was that the main thrust of the overall strategic deception?
Yes, I think it was, but I wasn't concerned with it. You see, I'm very parochial in that I was dealing with a particular theatre.
So you were dealing with North Africa and then with Italy?
North Africa, Italy, and then Germany itself. But my story allowed for all sorts of things, and those would be communicated to the theatre concerned. In other words, to a commander-in-chief's area. So he didn't mess things up. And this is something that a lot of people couldn't work out, why it was that they were forbidden to do any form of deception at all.
Because they might have cut across
yours. They might have cut across and messed the whole thing up. Not intentionally, but by accident. In the desert it was easier, much easier, because it was an empty place anyhow. Going up Italy was a bit more difficult, and when
because of the population.
The population, and we had the Americans and the Brits toddling along, but they weren't just the same. I mean, we had troops sent right across to the wrong direction. But you see, you never had time just sit back, because you were always on to the next operation.
Playing a game of squash.
Yes, quite right.
The next point is the only one that matters.
And you've forgotten the one before. Well, obviously, you've got things left in your mind, but one worked very, very hard in those days, and very, very long hours.
Most of your work really was thinking, wasn't it? It was conceptual work, and then putting that into practice.
Yes.
With your orders and briefings, presumably.
Yes, but then you see, I had to go out into the field.
To see that things were being done properly.
Oh, yes. And that's... I got a lot of trouble about that from one time, but I insisted on going into the field. You've got to go where the troops are, I think. After I always came back.
Why did you get into trouble? Was it because you were putting yourself at risk?
Yes. For the invasion of Sicily, we had a diversionary thing by air, and I went on one airplane. I had four aircraft assigned to me, and we were dropping things called pintails, which are these little things they dropped, which sent up a very hit the ground and up went very light and that kind of thing, and dummy parachutes and all sorts of things. And unfortunately, to our total regret, the plane behind us, in the leading plane, some person, unknown now, dropped or kicked or something one of the pintails, and it went down onto the floor of the plane, and of course, being a very light, it set everything on fire, and the thing ditched, and it lost everybody. And when I reported this, it was a stink back from Cairo, because I prejudiced the thing by going on this thing myself, and what had happened if I hadn't come back? Well, somebody else would have taken over. And you can't put yourself in a little cage. He said, I can't. And you go on and get on with the job. But by going on that thing and identifying myself with it, it stopped anything of saying, well, he'd sent us off. Where was he himself? We couldn't have parachutes because the RAF hadn't got enough parachutes. So the answer was no parachutes, which was the right answer. You're under them when you're flying. I mean, so nobody had a parachute. Seems fair due. Who was going to have one if there are only three left? What? There we are. But these are minor things.
Now you're saying that you really started to get organised properly once you got back to Britain and were organising for the D-Day and
yes,
the Northwest European campaign. Could you tell me about that, about the way things were, the way policy was settled and the way you got yourself organised with armed force?
Well, the first thing to do was to review the plan that had been made for the deception.
Operation Fortitude?
Yes, Fortitude South. And I rewrote it. Entirely.
What was wrong with the original version?
It was too complicated and too... It isn't fair to say this, but the people who'd made it had not ever done it before. Now, they did their best, and their best was jolly good in that they got a lot of work done, which wouldn't otherwise have been done. But it didn't suit the actual operation which Monty was considering and so on and so forth. So I rewrote the thing entirely. And Monty agreed it. That was that. Because he was commander-in-chief and that was the finish. The office up in London were a bit upset. But they just had to accept it, which they did very loyally and well. But obviously, I'd been doing this kind of thing for, 3 years, whatever it was. And obviously one had a... It was easier for me than it was for them. But they had to start from scratch without any experience. This is no criticism of them. That's why we went back. We were taken back home to do the job because Monty insisted he brought certain people back with him. And I was one of them.
Of course, he himself had entirely rewritten the original plan.
Oh, absolutely. he rewrote everything. But he was right. He was the Commander-in-Chief. You can't just take over somebody's plan and get on. It must be your own plan. And he was right. The trouble was he sometimes sort of said it too bluntly. You could be very careful on these things. But still, he had got a job to do and he did it. But they did a lot of preparation in the reception line. They got all these dummy barges and things made. They got all sorts of things done, which was essential. And we used them.
That had all been done before you came back.
Yes, it was done before I came back. I modified some of it. I cut some of it. It was a waste of time.
What sort of things did you cut as being a waste of time?
Well, some of the barges they had were of no importance, which was a waste of manpower and effort. But they'd forgotten, this is what happens, one of the main things. The enemy were unable to fly over England then properly at all, but they could get it faster towards the coast. And what they'd forgotten is that there were all these lovely landing craft. But where the hell were the troops to come from to get onto them? And they'd forgotten to make any hards on the coast. Well, once I sort of got going and started, I said, "Oi, where are the hards?" There weren't any hards. So I went to chief engineer, Monty's chief engineer, and said, "We've got to have hards, you see. And they've got to be so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so." I said, "Right." So he got the chief engineer, I think they called it Eastern Command in those days.
Based at Colchester, presumably.
Yeah, I think somewhere there. And he summoned a recce and a conference, and I sent my number two, a man called, never mind, it'll come back. And I sent him off to be my representative, in other words, Monty's representative, on the job on the ground where they were doing the recce. And he is a tall, lank, dreamy-looking cavalry officer. In fact, was a big business person. He was the Earl of Stowe. That's right. He came back late at night and reported. He said, "Yes, they're going to build them." I knew there was something behind what he was saying. He'd been with me in North Africa. So I said, "What have you been up to?" "Well," he said, "they decided that the job couldn't be done." So I said, "What'd you do?" "Well, if you can't do it, I will do it. I'm the biggest muck shifter in England." Of course, he was too. He used to make most of the roads of England and things. And, or his firm did, she ran. And the poor old engineer was so ashamed about this when he discovered who was sitting there looking so drippy and thing, that he said they could do it after all. So after all, they were done.
Were they done fully?
Oh, absolutely. You get an air photograph. Chap's only got to come within, 15 miles of the coast and take a angle photograph, and they've got it. And if it's wrong, it'll be just seen at once.
You can't make dummy hearts then?
No, not likely. Not if you want to. You don't make dummy hearts, because if they're dummy and they're spotted as dummy, you've done the very thing that you shouldn't have done. Better no hearts at all. And so they were made. And
roads to the hards as well?
Everything was organised.
Water points and things of that sort?
Anything that can be seen, you have got to do. You see, so much depended upon the success of the deception plan. If we hadn't got away with that deception plan, goodness knows what would have happened. And remember, we kept the enemy off the area, I think it was 15 to 20 days. And he didn't move, because he thought we were going where we... Their old Air Force, they played jolly good ball. For every reconnaissance in the actual operation area, I had two reconnaissances flown in the dummy area.
It's the 15th Army area.
Yeah.
What about the Navy? Were they also helpful?
Same. Oh, yes.
What kind of things did they do, which were...
For every reconnaissance they did on shore in the rail area, two were done in my area. And they accepted it. They could see it. Must be. For their own protection. Because they can keep the enemy forces up there and not down here. You've got to be ruthless on this kind of thing. It's horrible. I used to feel miserable about this when you knew you were sending a fellow on a reconnaissance, which wasn't a real reconnaissance in that you needed to know how to get up that cliff. He might get bumped off. But this you've got to do. Because if you don't do it, then many, many, many more are going to get bumped off.
In a way, it's just his bad luck, isn't it?
It is. Well, so of course, they get back and they've learnt something anyhow. Both the Army, Air Force and Navy played ball magnificently. And I can have seen that many commanders must have been fairly irritated that they were wasting time on some foolish plan. And by Jove, they didn't complain about it afterwards.
What about the organisation that you set up?
The first thing I did was to slash the number of officers that had been given me.
That's a very unusual proceeding for a commander to do, to cut his own force back.
I have a great principle, that unless you're stretched, you can't do any good. And the bigger your headquarters, as we used to rudely say, the bigger the balls.
Would this be because people would be getting in each other's way? Or?
Well, no. Travel light. All I wanted was sufficient good officers to meet the needs of an operation. And in some ways, the fewer there are, the better. Because they're stretched, they're given more responsibility and more confidence, self-confidence in what they're doing. But you see, the really guilty people were the camouflage experts. And they'd built up a vast empire. Well, the army was supposed to train their own people. not have specialists for camouflage. Certain things need special treatment, but they're only unusual things for the army. They're not normal army things, and they should damn well do their own camouflage. So I had, I think 20-odd camouflage people on my staff, theoretically. So they were cut. I finished up with three.